Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 28 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sabalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. It's summertime and the living is easy. It's the perfect time to go on vacation. But where should history buffs go to get their medieval fix? I don't know about you, but when it comes to figuring out what I should see, I like to get recommendations from friends. So with that in mind, Peter Konieczny from medievalist.net and I are here to tell you about some of the best places we visited ourselves. For both of us, that's narrowed down to Europe due to circumstance, but we're hoping that you'll share some of your recommendations with the rest of our listeners on social media after you've heard ours, and we'd love to hear about your favorite sites from all over the globe. So Peter and I have done some traveling in Europe. I haven't gone too far south, but you've gone to different places in Europe, so we're going to talk a little bit about what our favorite places or suggested places to visit are, right? So Peter, do you want to go first?
Sure. And I'll probably start with like the very first castle I ever saw, and this is dating back a long time ago, but it's a place called Malbork. It's in Poland. It's also known as Marienburg. It's a 15th century castle that was built by the Teutonic Knights when they kind of ruled the kind of area that is now northern Poland. So it's, I always thought it was like a very incredibly beautiful and huge castle. Apparently this is the largest brick castle in the world and the largest brick building in Europe. And it is, it's just one of those, you know, if you're looking at kind of fortifications, this is kind of a very large and fascinating one. It's kind of three different castles in one, almost.
What do you mean by three different castles in one?
When it was designed so that if you'd had attack, you'd have to go through kind of like one kind of castle-like area before you could get into the next castle. And then there'd be a third one kind of buried within it. It's shaped very rectangular. It has that kind of in-depth fortification to it. An interesting kind of a site that had to be rebuilt extensively after World War II. There was a lot of fighting that took place at that castle during the war. So there are still some renovations and reconstructions that have just been done recently to it. There's all sorts of kind of castles that one might want to explore. Ones I kind of enjoy, other kinds are like ones that are very much ruins, like only little bits of it. There are others that have been reshaped over centuries, so like it's only like a little bit of a medieval castle, something like, you know, Windsor Castle. You know, there's some medieval parts of it, I suppose, but that's much more of a, like a modern creation. You know, Tower of London has its, you know, parts of that are like date back to the high Middle Ages, and others date back into the early modern period. Lots of different kind of fortifications to kind of take a look at, but Malbork is one I would suggest.
So is Malbork a ruin, or can you go in the rooms?
Yeah, you can go into the rooms. Parts of it are now a museum. They also have on site some of the like siege weaponry that reconstructed. So it's very much a tourist site. When I was there, it was so long ago that there wasn't quite as much material on the inside, but I believe that's changed over the years as that's become a much more popular tourist destination.
So you haven't been there for quite a long time. Would you go back?
Definitely. I do plan on going back. I'm Polish, so, you know, I go back once sooner or later back to the old country. So, yes.
That's important. So for me, I haven't gone too far south in Europe. The farthest south I've gone is France and the northern part of France. So I'm going to talk about a few different places that I like. And I'm going to start with the southernmost of the ones that I've picked out, and that is Le Mont Saint-Michel, which is in Normandy. So it's off the coast of France and it sits in the ocean, and it's a really cool place because when the tide is in, it's inaccessible by a road. Still, when the tide goes out, then you can drive out to there, but it's been inaccessible because it's an island throughout its history, which makes it kind of a really interesting place. It was built to have an abbey at the top of it. So it was built for Christian worship. And it still has people that live there all the time. There's only a few dozen people that live there, but you basically get onto the island, you know, at sea level, and then you climb and climb and climb and climb to the top. So if you ever see a picture of the Mont Saint-Michel in profile, it's really beautiful because you have kind of this winding mountain to the top, and then you have the abbey at the top of it. And it's a really cool place because it's well preserved. Over its history, it's been attacked a few times, several times, without a lot of success because it's hard to get to and it's hard to get to the top of it. And it was fortified because it had been attacked before. So it's not only beautiful, but it's an interesting place in terms of where it's situated. So when you go there, because it hasn't been all that modernized, you're following kind of twisty streets, medieval streets on the way up and up and up. And they have really excellent food there, really excellent French food there as well. But for me, it was a beautiful place that had all sorts of history. It was established in the early Middle Ages, so it's been around for a really long time. And the story goes that Saint Michael, Saint Michel, actually visited a holy man and told him he needed to build an abbey on that site. Now, when I went there, the tour guide said that Saint Michael had touched the flaming sword or flaming finger to the head of this holy man, and that there was a hole there afterwards, which I think is a great story. Whether this is just a tourist story or what, I don't know. But I think it's a great story, and this is why they built it.
I just one question is the logistics of going there. Now, tide comes in. Is it like, hey, a tide just came out. Oh, I can't get there for another 6 hours. Or like, how does it run when you're off the coast and there's like only a certain amount of time that the road is passable into it?
Well, I mean, there are boats, right? You can still get across by boat. And it's been a long time since I've been there. I don't know if they have built a bridge or anything like that, but it was important to get back on the bus or get back in your car before the tide came in. And I remember there being Zambonis that kind of, sorry, this Canadian word, there were sort of like street sweepers that were cleaning the silt off of the parking lot so that people could see where the lines were and they could park during the day. But you do want to get back before the tide comes in. You know, I think that it's not dire if you're stuck there. There are places that you could stay. But I mean, if of all the places to be stuck when the tide came in, this is a really gorgeous place to do that. And it is filled with history. I mean, you can't have a site that's on the coast of Normandy that's not full of history. Like, apparently this was a place where they supported William the Conqueror. Obviously, Normandy's a place that was important during World War II as well. But Le Mont Saint-Michel has a really nicely preserved abbey, medieval abbey. And you can follow the streets, like I said, as if you were in the Middle Ages, which is kind of awesome.
Is it basically a full day experience?
I would spend the day there, yeah. Because, well, first of all, you have to get out there. And secondly, because it's a place for tourists, you have all these really great places to visit on the way up to the abbey. And for me, I could easily spend a couple hours in an abbey, especially one that is beautiful and well-designed. So for me, yeah, it's a day out if you're ever in France. Did you want to tell us about your next favorite site?
Yes, I did. And this one's actually not a medieval place. It is a reconstruction. And it's called the Medieval Center, and it's in Denmark. It's on the kind of southeast kind of coastal area. There are several kind of places in Europe where they've attempted to kind of do living history, kind of recreate historical places, Middle Ages. And this, I think, is one of the best ones I ever have come across and heard about. It is basically a village that's kind of set up to look like the early 15th century. And where there are numerous kinds of houses and buildings, everything you kind of would kind of see in a little medieval village that's been kind of faithfully reconstructed. So you get to walk around, you get to interact with people that are in costume, that are kind of showing life back then. So you'll have the blacksmith, and he'll be working away, and he can talk to you and teach you about his trade. Weavers, a lot of them, they said like they're kind of hired to for the entire season. and many of them actually stay on the grounds for extended periods of time. They kind of just live in the places. So besides visiting there, you can actually rent like accommodations and stay for a week. And I wound up talking with kind of people that kind of did it, and they said, yeah, that, you know, we love doing it. They have the most fun at night once all the guests are kind of gone, then they go party.
Party medieval stuff.
Exactly. I don't know exactly what they're doing, but they seem to be having fun. And meanwhile, they also have things like they have trebuchets that will fire out into the waters right off the coast. They've got knights doing the jousting, things like that. Little kind of areas where you can kind of explore various kinds of medieval machines. They have little boats that kind of can be sailed around. And just that kind of wonderful little experience of learning about the Middle Ages, learning about the past. It's a little further away from like the kind of areas of Denmark. So it's, I remember it's about a 2-hour train ride from Copenhagen. But it's especially if you have kids, I think that'd be a kind of a wonderful way of getting to them to show the kind of medieval life.
So when you're there, is it Disneyland touristy, or is it like you've been deposited in a medieval village?
It's more of the latter, where you've been deposited in a medieval village. They make a lot of effort to properly recreate. They do actually do some research there as well. This is a place where I know they did a lot of research on gunpowder. So they tried to do faithfully recreate it. And so I think it's quite good.
So how long do you think you should spend there? Like if you're planning to go there, how long would be a good amount of time to spend there?
I would say about 3 hours, 3 to 4 hours. So it's something that I think you could probably pair up if you were, say, were driving. You could probably pair up with going to another place as well. It is a, kind of a bit off the kind of beaten track, I think, of Denmark. You'd have to kind of see what else you can kind of do in the area, but it's not something you necessarily need to spend like 6 or 8 hours at. So I think you can pretty much go through the whole kind of site in about 3 hours.
Okay. So how, I'm trying to get a concept of it. So like how many people are working there, like hundreds or dozens, or what are we looking at?
I would say there was about 30 to 40 people that were kind of working there. Some of the people were there, they kind of work almost kind of a full-time basis, that like whenever it's open. Others seem to be kind of coming there for like a couple weeks at a time. So I wasn't quite sure who was a guest and who was actually like a dedicated employee. So, but when I talked to them, they said like, yeah, this is, you know, a really fascinating thing that, you know, we've loved and kind of cherished. So
wait, so you can tell if people were working there. So are people showing up in costume then?
It's if you're staying there, if you kind of like have your little medieval peasant little house, you actually will be in costume. And I ran into like two kind of teenagers that like, yeah, this is, you know, what we're doing on our summer holiday. And like, this is what you do for fun? Yeah, yeah. You know, we're really enjoying it. So
actually does sound like a lot of fun. And it's nice that you see teenagers getting involved in that, right? Enthusiastic about the Middle Ages. So you go back there too?
Yeah, I definitely have. If I have a chance to be back in Denmark, yeah, I that's something I really like to explore. And I love just going around taking photos.
Yeah, absolutely. If I talk about another one of sites that I like, and speaking of places to go back to, I go back to York. So if I, you know, if my southernmost site that I'm talking about today is Le Mont-Saint-Michel, then I'm moving up to York in England. So when people ask me, like, what do I need to see that's medieval when I go to England? For me, it's York. I mean, Tower of London is great, but it's not the same thing. And York is a great city because it has most of its medieval walls still intact. So you can get a sense of how big the city would have been, the walled city back in the day. And York was such an important city for English history. I mean, so many things happened there. There was always a sort of a site of government there when they needed to take care of things in the north. And so York is an important site. So when you go to York, you can walk the walls, which is amazing. You can visit Clifford's Tower, which we'll get to in a second. You can visit York Minster, and you can visit the Shambles. And the Shambles is a really cool place. It's one of the one of the coolest places that you can see if you're a medievalist, because it is a medieval street that is really well preserved. I mean, it's got modern shops in it. And the first four shops, if you come at it from the south, are all Harry Potter themed. So if you're a Harry Potter fan, I mean, stop there. But you can see, so the Shambles used to be a street on which they did butchery. But now it's a tourist site. But you can see how closely the buildings were built to each other. You can see the gutters, you can see the gables, and you can see how things were built and how they're kind of leaning on each other. And it's just, it's beautiful. And beyond that, there's the best chocolate ever. I mean, Candace Robb, who was on the podcast a few months ago, when she found out I was going to York last year, we met last year, she said, you definitely need to go to Monk Bar Chocolates. And I have to say, this is the best chocolate ever. You have to try it. Have you been to York before?
Yeah. I've been a couple of times to York, and you know, I find York Minster unbelievably beautiful. I also really like the kind of Viking museum there, which is this kind of a recreation, kind of a bit of a, they use a bit of a kind of a theme park ride aspect to it, but I thought it was really well done. I really enjoyed it, and that's actually that park helps support the archaeology that's going on right in that region. So
yeah, that's the Jorvik Center, and so York was an important town in Viking Age as well. It's like throughout the Middle Ages, really important. But you're talking about the Minster. York Minster is the cathedral in the middle of town. And it is so gorgeous and well-preserved. And there is this beautiful room in it where Edward I had his councils. So when Edward was going up and he was going to subdue the Scots, he had his government there for a while. And there's this beautiful room in it. And it's got all these sculptured heads that are making, you know, all sorts of faces. And they're animals and they're people and they're making funny faces. And beyond that, the stained glass is just absolutely breathtaking. And when I was there last, which was last summer, I stayed to listen to Evensong, and that was just amazing. I mean, you can really get a sense of the Middle Ages when you hear people singing in Latin, and it's just beautiful, beautiful. And then beyond that, Clifford's Tower is something to visit. So this is like York Castle, but people call it Clifford's Tower after the people who owned it for a really long time. And Clifford's Tower is an important place, not only strategically, so you can go up there and see the vision of what does York look like from here, kind of a strategic position and a view of the city. But it's also the site where York had a huge massacre of Jews. I'm saying massacre, it was actually a mass suicide, but it was a mass suicide because the entire city of York had chased the Jews to Clifford's Tower to persecute them. And instead of allowing themselves to be captured, the fathers of the family killed their children and their wives and then themselves. And so it was just a devastating moment in York's history, a very bloody moment. And they say that the walls ran red of Clifford's Tower on anniversaries of that massacre. So that is a place that is full of history as well. And so if you were to visit York, I'd say you definitely need a few days, because you'd want to see the Minster, you'd want to see that and explore that fully. You'd want to see Clifford's Tower. You'd want to walk the walls as well. You'd want to do the Jorvik Center. So there's all sorts of things to do in York. Am I missing anything?
I also think it's a really good starting off point for going to other places in Northern England. I think a lot of trains kind of use that as a kind of a crossing point. So there's other things you can explore that aren't too far away, so that you can use York as a nice little base of operations. So
yeah, and that's kind of the function that it had in the Middle Ages as well. So it's a great city. If you're going to England and you can visit one city that had to do with the medieval era, I would recommend York for sure. So what's last on your list, Peter?
It is a place in Iceland. It's called Thingvellir, and it is the kind of traditional site where the Althing took place, which is the kind of Icelandic parliament. Basically, it's an outdoor natural site that is stunningly beautiful, like much of Iceland is. Iceland, as many of you know, has had like the kind of a tourism boom in the last 5-10 years. I've had a chance to visit it myself. I really want to go back. And this was one of the sites that I wanted to go and visit. It's basically part of the Golden Circle, which is kind of a route of main tourist sites outside of Reykjavik. So it's fairly easy to go to. On the surface, there's not anything medieval to see because it's actually just a park. It's a natural area. It is this kind of valley that people would have camped at when they did the All Thing. And there was a large kind of rock area where people would read off the laws and do judgments and things like that. And that's there. But there's no kind of buildings that are medieval. There's, I believe, 19th century buildings there, like a church and a couple of houses, which are interesting to see, but they're not, you know. If you're like, this is the medieval past, you're not going to see that, but you do get a nice sense of this place that, you know, has a lot of history to it, and also kind of that beauty that you come to expect when you visit that country. So if you're looking for a nice hike, a nice walk past like some waterfalls and areas like that, that is something, you know, just again, you want to explore. If you're part of a bus tour or something like that, they may only stay there for like an hour or so, but you know, it's also a place you can camp at. I might try, and if I next time I go, is try and spend like a full day just exploring that area. So, but it's something you could probably, literally, if you want to kind of rush through it, you could do that as well. So
because there aren't a lot of buildings there, is there information on the site that tells you about the medieval site, or did you have to look into that before you got there?
There are a lot of actually signs that you can kind of come along with. There's little trails that kind of lead you around. Some of the signs aren't particularly useful, or like you can get lost wandering around. But it's there's a little bit of information, and I think you try and let your imagination take you a bit. So.
Okay. So if you wanted to know about it as a Viking site, you'd probably read about it before you got there, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. You can learn about it. It's really part of Iceland's history. It was a working site from the year 930 until the 18th century. So it's got a lot of kind of a past to it, but you have to kind of appreciate it for its natural beauty as well.
So I'm going to come a little bit south from Iceland and talk about a fantastic Scottish castle. Now, you may not know this about me, but I lived in Scotland for a little while, and it has my heart. I am Canadian, and then after that, you know, I have to go back to those Scottish roots because it is just an absolutely gorgeous country to visit, and everyone should go there. So when I lived there, I lived in Edinburgh. And so you've seen on medievalist.net, if you follow my writing, when I lived there, my favorite castle was Craigmillar Castle, which is right outside of Edinburgh. And it's a lot better to visit, to me, than Edinburgh Castle itself. Because if you're looking for medieval history, you won't find a lot of it in Edinburgh Castle because it's been rebuilt several times. But Craigmillar Castle is a 14th century castle. I guess it's within the city limits, but it's by the hospital. And from there, you can see Arthur's Seat, you can see Edinburgh Castle, and you can see the Firth of Forth. So for reasons why I love that castle, you can see that on medievalists.net. I think the article was 5 minutes at Craigmillar Castle. So I love that one. But a couple of years ago, I got to visit Doune Castle. And Doune Castle is definitely a rival for Craigmillar Castle in my heart because it is another 14th century castle. And it is... it's a ruin, but it's in fantastic shape. And so there you can see it's not a really well fortified castle in that it doesn't have an exterior wall around it, but it is a great castle in terms of it's been well preserved. And it is a castle that you'll see in almost every movie that features a castle. So you'll see it in Outlaw King. You'll see it in Monty Python. And you'll see it in Outlander as well, which is not a medieval show. And if you go there, you can take two audio tours. And the first one is a medieval tour, and it's narrated by Terry Jones of Monty Python. Because it's appropriate, right? They have filmed part of it there, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And so Terry Jones is a great medieval scholar, and you can hear him talk about each of the rooms as you go through them, which is fantastic. But if you are an Outlander fan, you can do the auto tour where you're listening to Jamie Fraser talk about the castle. So there is something for everybody there. But I love this castle because it's in such great shape. You can see things like the well. You can see things, the bedrooms. The bedrooms have garderobes in them. So they have bathrooms, which is fantastic. And there's even one that has a two-seater bathroom, which is great. But I mean, this is a luxurious thing to have a bathroom inside, kind of an ensuite. But the kitchens are in really great shape. The great hall is in really great shape, and all of it, you can walk around, and it's fairly easy. I mean, you do have to have a good pair of shoes, but you can really get a sense of how a building like this was used in the 14th century. Again, not a really well fortified one, so this one would have been more of a home. But because of that, you can actually kind of get a sense of what it would have been like to live in a castle like that. And so this is one of the reasons I really like that. That and I, you know, am partial to both the 14th century and Scotland. So, you know, it's a no-brainer for me.
Now, is it more, the reason why is it used for movies, is it because it's so picturesque from the exterior, or is it something on the interior that's really attractive? Like, what makes it such a beautiful place for like films and things like that?
I think it's used mostly for film because of the exterior. So while it is a ruin, so it doesn't have all parts of the roof, for example, fully intact, or all of the floors within fully intact. So for example, where you would have had a floor or like a ceiling, you can see up a couple of floors. So it's not used for interior shots that much, but it is used for exterior shots quite a lot. And that's because the form of it is in fantastic shape. And it has, you know, your grand castle entrance with portcullis type thing and a nice little road leading up to it. And it is kind of Mott and Bailey style in that it is on a little bit of a raised hill, not very high. But I think it's because the exterior is so fully intact that that's why they use it. For Outlander, I think they filmed some of it there, which you can't really fake that well because they are using the courtyard and the well and things like that. But they recreated the interior of Dune Castle to make a set for Outlander. So part of it is filmed there. And once you are there, you can't watch Outlander without being like, oh my gosh, I know this spot. I was standing right there. But they did recreate it for a set rather than just using it there. But it's mostly the exterior.
One thing I like about castles is sometimes the kind of the ruin on the inside, I find it a little more fascinating. You know, Rochester Castle, I think that was one for me where the exterior is beautiful, but what really drew me in was the kind of haunted aspect of the interior, which is really, you know, ruins. Like, it's, you know, you can, it's several floors, but you can look right up to the top, and you, or when you're at top, you can look right down at the bottom. It's one of those where, you know, you have to go on certain paths because it's way too dangerous to walk around, to go around anywhere. But it's like, like for you, Dune Castle, like the interior has kind of been rebuilt and kind of, or not rebuilt, but modified.
The interior hasn't really been modified. It's still the way it was. So that's why I like it, because you can imagine how the rooms were used. And one of the things that I like about that kind of a castle is the views from the windows. So as you're talking about Rochester Castle, yeah, Rochester Castle is a really cool one because, like you say, it's so square and it's so tall and you can see like how high it went. And it was making me think as well of another Scottish castle that I visited called Donatar. And that one is a coastal one. And from those windows, you can see it was invaded by Vikings. And you could see from the windows, you could have seen Vikings approaching for quite a long time and known that you were in for it. And so that kind of looking, well, it's true. It's one of the things I find most striking about castles. And I do love castles even more than cathedrals. For that reason, you can picture how it was used in daily life. And of course, daily life is my jam. It's what I love. So Dune Castle, the layout of it tells you a lot about people living there. The fact that they have luxuries like garderobes tells you a lot about people living there. How the kitchens were used, where it was situated in terms of the Great Hall, where they stored things. So Dune Castle, not only the audio tour, but also some of the plaques and stuff tell you a little bit about that. And Craig Miller as well, there are plaques that tell you, you know, this is where Mary Queen of Scots was at this time and that kind of thing.
If you did like an itinerary, how would like you're at Edinburgh, how do you kind of like you go to Craigmillar Castle first and then you head off to Dune? Can you be both done in one day?
Can you do Craigmillar and Dune in one day? You can if you have a car. I don't think you'd have an easy time trying to do this public transport style. But you know, Craigmillar is a place that you can get to taking a city bus. So you just take the city bus and you get off before the hospital, and there's this little kind of dirt track, and you walk up some hills, and then just as you get over the rise of a hill, there it is. You see it. And the last time I was there, just as I was leaving it, there was a beautiful rainbow over top of it. I think we used that picture for the article. So you can get there by city bus, and you can do it in a couple of hours. And again, Craigmillar, you want to have a good pair of shoes because it is a ruin. But you can definitely do that in a couple of hours. For me, I'd spend a lot of time there because I just love this castle. For Dune, you'd want to have a car. And you can see that again in a couple hours. For me, you don't want to rush a castle. Like take the audio guide and actually let people tell you about it. Because even someone like me or you who's studied castles for a while, you can still get surprised by what we know about this. So allow the historians to tell you over the audio guide what they've learned about it. So could you do them both in one day? Yeah, you could. But then you get them muddled in your head. So do something else, like go to St. Giles Cathedral in between.
Sorry, that sounds like good advice.
Yeah. I can tell you lots about Edinburgh. That's another podcast entirely. So was there anything else that you wanted to tell us about sites that you have seen or wish you could see?
I'd love to get like our viewers to say, hey, like this is a real medieval gem to kind of go explore. I really want to go to Wales to see the kind of Edward's the first kind of the castles that were built in his reign. Those would be, I think, be really fascinating to look at.
Yes, I went to Conwy Castle and that was amazing. It's so beautiful.
Also, the kind of churches, like we haven't talked too much about churches, but some of them are incredible, like Sainte-Chapelle in Paris is an amazingly beautiful sight. Unfortunately, I was there with like 1,000 other people. So, but if somehow you could get there with just a handful of people and kind of take it in slowly, I think that'd be incredible. I don't know if that's much of a possibility these days, but churches often, have that kind of mystique on its their own that. It takes, you can enjoy it and explore it, and just kind of sit there and kind of meditate or just have your mind open to it.
Yeah, I think for North Americans, there is a lot to just be seen by walking around in Europe and actually just walking the streets and seeing how they're laid out, because they are not laid out in the same straight lines that a lot of things are in North America. And the same with the cathedrals. You'll see something that is easily hundreds of years old, which is something you don't see in North America. And so it's kind of nice. You can just kind of wander around in many cities in Europe and just experience things, which I highly recommend.
Yes. Please travel more to Europe. I think every country has something to offer, and like we've kind of talked about, like countries in Northern Europe, but Italy obviously has things, Spain, Greece, all those kind of wonderful cities, and that's just in Europe. I think hopefully as we do more and more work on medievalist.net, we'll have opportunity to travel like further afield into Africa, Asia. To kind of explore kind of historical sites there as well.
Yeah, exactly. Today is limited only by the fact that we haven't traveled to all of these places, but they are on the bucket list, right, Peter?
Oh yeah. Like I literally want to, go everywhere across the world. So we gotta figure out ways to do that, right?
And the Philosopher's Stone, I think we need that as well. So if you want to tell us about your favorite places that you visited, then definitely tell us on Twitter, on Facebook, and of course, at the end of the show, I'll give you all of that information that you can do that. So, Peter, what's on the website this week?
Our kind of team of writers have delivered some really great stuff. You can start by reading about more about Valkyries with Beth Rogers, kind of finishing up a kind of a little mini series on the Norse mythological creatures, and her latest post is talking about like how they're kind of portrayed in the modern. So, hey, if you know your Marvel movies, you might know about a person named Valkyrie. So she talks a bit about that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, when you think about Valkyries, you have to think about Thor Ragnarok, right?
Exactly, exactly. And she's going to be a character that's going to get even more exposure. So, with the next Thor film. So,
can't wait. I have to say, I love the Thor films. What else is on the website, Peter?
We also have a fairly lengthy piece about warfare during the Crusades. It's through the eyes of Usama ibn Munqid. He's like a 12th century Syrian nobleman, and he had left his memoirs, and it's like a lot of fascinating insights into the kind of warfare and living in that kind of with the Crusader states. So we have that, and we also have a piece on fantastic beasts. So this is the kind of creatures created more or less the imaginations of medieval writers and ancient writers, and you can find them in bestiaries. So check those things out this week on medievalist.net.
Sounds awesome. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, and thanks for having me on again.
My pleasure. If you love the podcast and your friendly neighborhood Medieval Globetrotters, why not check out our Patreon page to find out how you can help us keep it going. You can grab yourself a digital or paper subscription to Medieval Warfare magazine and help out at the same time. Check out patreon.com/medievalists. If there's a place you've traveled that you'd like to tell us about, why not drop us a line on social media, on Facebook or Twitter at Medievalists. You can also get in touch with me, Danielle Sabalski, across social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And if you want to know more about life in medieval Europe, you can pre-order my new book, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for letting us share some of our favorite memories with you. Have yourself an awesome day.